talked about that a little bit at the beginning of the show. Jack, did you hear the question?
Yeah.
Would you like to elaborate on any of the conversations we had earlier tonight?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, some of the influences, well, let's see.
I know we already talked a little bit about Ahmad Jamal's trio and Elvin Jones.
Yeah, well, you know, there were people like Ramsey Lewis. He had a trio. There was Eddie Harris, who actually convinced me that I should, you know, make drums my main instrument. And I worked with Eddie for a time. Muhal Richard Abrams, who was very instrumental in helping me be a freer thinking musician. And he started the AACM, Music for Advancement of Creative Musicians in Chicago. Miles, Max Roach, Roy Haynes, Charlie Mingus, let's see, who else? Modern Jazz Quartet, which also I used to listen to, John Lewis, Mel Jackson, Connie Kay, and Percy Heath, just to name a few.
Johnny, are you a musician yourself?
Yeah, I am.
Well, what instrument do you play and what are some of your influences?
I would say Chris Kummer would be a big influence of mine, some of the sessions I've done with
but
him.
But what do you play? You play?
I play the flute myself. But
what are some of the flute players you heard when you were a youngster, first learning some of the chops on the flute?
Oh, people like Eric Dolphy,
Eric is one of my influences also. I like his writing, I like his playing. Go ahead.
I was more influenced by other different types of music, which leads me to my next question, which is, aside from American jazz and other forms that were in your immediate surroundings, what types of music from around the world, be they European classical or music from West Africa or Caribbean music, how did these other different types of music come into your sphere of influence? Were there some particular things that you liked?
Well, you know, as a kid, when I listened to music, I was always attracted to music from all over the world. I mean, we used to have a shortwave radio. Used to pick up music from all over. So I used to just scan the radio and listen to different music. I mean, I didn't know what it was. I used to listen to Russian music. I used to listen to classical music. I used to listen to country and western. I used to listen to Grand Ole Opry. I used to listen to blues. I used to listen to gospel. And I just liked it. I liked the variety of music. So I never had categories for it, you know. And so, listening to East Indian music, West African music, Indonesian music, you know, each one has something. I think the thread that puts all these music together is the intention and the commitment to the music that the musicians have, you know, like West African musicians, East Africa, you know, Arab music, Egyptian music, Turkish music, you know, there's a sincere thing in the music, intention in music, or even sometimes a spiritual aspect of the music, Sufi music I like. You know, then I'm drawn to it.
Does that answer your question, Johnny?
Yes. Well put, and I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you so much, Jack.
Okay, man.
Thanks for calling in, Johnny.
All right.
Are there, you know, sometimes when a Western musician, whether he's from a classical or a jazz or a rock or any other tradition, sometimes a musician will hear some indigenous folk music from some other culture where the tonality is different and the musicians have a different approach to the way they play, and you can incorporate that into your compositions, your improvisation, the way you play. Is there anything that ever that you ever heard, maybe whether it was from any of the different continents around the world, that you gravitated towards and incorporated into your own compositions or improvisations?
I mean
consciously, because unconsciously we suck it all in every day, everywhere we go, whether you're in town or out of town and you hear some street musicians or you hear something on the radio. But is there anything that you consciously put your hands around and said, I'm going to incorporate that into my next group?
Well, you know, what I did was, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's an album that I was called Music for the Fifth World. It was done on a Blue Note album. And it featured, Native American musicians, and so it was my tribute to a Seneca elder named Grandma Twyla Meech, who initiated me and my family into the Seneca Wolf Clan up in near Buffalo. And she talked about the fifth world, the native Seneca teaching talks about the world of creation and the different worlds. And of course, native people, I mean, I have some native blood, part Seminole and Crow. And, Grandma Twyla Leach wrote a book called Other Council Fires Were Here Before Us. And, Native people get messages and information from rocks and the wind and rain. And she had this rock called Giok. It spoke to her about these, the five worlds of, five worlds, and that we were in the fifth world. And the fourth world was the end of... world of separation, and we're now moving into the world of integration, and which is happening to some degree. The world of separation is still holding on, trying to maintain the dualistic control over things. But anyway, Grandma Twyla Meech wrote this thing, this book, Music. Other councils were here before us, and she was talking a lot about the fifth world, so I wrote some music inspired by that that scene. And on this CD, I had Will Calhoun also on drums and two guitars. I had John Schofield and Vernon Reed on guitar, Lonnie Plaxico from my special edition band, and my oldest daughter, Farah, and Native American singer and contributor to the CD, to the music, Joan Henry. And I wrote some pieces called, Music for the Fifth World. I wrote some pieces in Odd Time Eater. I also wrote a piece dedicated to Miles called Miles, because Miles had passed away then.
Mm-hmm.
And see, these are CDs that, I hope I'm going to make this CD available, because it's really like, it's rock, it's like Native American, it's really eclectic. I wrote a piece on it called Dedicated to the Aboriginal Peoples. Not only this land of us, but also Australia. It's called Aboriginal Dreamtime. So, I'm really, that's one of my favorite CDs. I mean, I have others, but that's one that that went in a different direction. And it didn't fall into any kind of category, but it's really slamming.
Right, and you said that it's currently not available?
You can try and see if you can find it, but it was on Blue Note. Was it on the Manhattan label, which is a subsidiary of Blue Note?
Okay.
Again, I think they deleted these. And so I'm going to try and create the opportunity to get all these CDs off, the music off these other albums and make them available.
You know, sometimes these Japanese record companies will take these old jazz records and put them out on CD, but you still can't get them on an American label.
No, I'm already, it's been bugging me. I've been, I want to try and figure out a way to do that. To get it, to print them and put them up and make them available.
Okay. We've got another call on hold we're going to get to in just a minute, but since Johnny just called in and was talking about flute, it brought up something that I mention on the radio all the time, especially when I'm playing some old jazz records and I start thinking about it. In jazz music, you got millions of saxophone players and almost as many trumpet players. There's hundreds of millions of piano players, but the flute seems to be a criminally underrated instrument. And some of my favorite jazz records are flute records from guys like Yusef Lateef, Herbie Mann, even going back to Frank West. I've got a record by a guy named Newton. What's his first name?
James
Newton that I love. He's a great flute player.
Don't forget Hubert Laws.
Yeah, there's a few great flute players out there, but there's not millions of them like there are saxophone players. And I just wanted to bring that up and ask you if you have an opinion on the flute as a traditional jazz instrument, and if you feel the same way that I do, that there should be more flute players out there.
Well, I think because the nature of the flute, Charles Lloyd plays good flute also.
Yeah, but he doesn't play it enough. In fact, one time when I was interviewing Charles, I said, hey, we're lucky if there's one flute song per record. We're lucky. We count our blessings if your new record has one flute song on it. Why don't you do a whole record of just flute? Well, why don't more cats come out as flute players, even if the flute's a secondary instrument after a saxophone or clarinet or something? More guys should play the flute because it's a wonderful instrument, and enough cats haven't played it.
Well, I think you should ask guys who play that instrument. who seem to like to play more saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
Flute seems to be like a, because the instrument they want to play a different type of a mood or something like that. Actually, I like the alto flute. That's
yeah?
One of my favorite. I love the sound of the alto.
It's warm, isn't it?
It's really nice. I love that. And I like to hear the alto flute done more. That's a really rich instrument.
Well, when we get off the phone, let's both call Charles and see if he'll put a flute album out. I asked him that, and he's still yet to put one out. Let me ask you something else while we're talking about Charles. ECM just put out a new record. It's two CDs of Charles Lloyd and Billy Higgins. I think it's called Which Way Is East, and it was recorded just a month or so before Billy Higgins passed on. Have you heard that record? It's a fantastic record.
No, I haven't heard it yet.
We were talking about folk music from indigenous cultures around the world, and it seems like on that record, Charles and Billy go in between doing some more swinging jazz-type tunes to picking up some more exotic folk instruments and putting down tracks that are more, I'm reaching for a word here, but are more folky or, have more of that flavor, more of that exotic flavor. And it's a record worth checking out. I've been telling people about it since it came out.
Great. Well, speaking of, okay, that's good.
So I'll go out and get that Ahmad Jamal record you want me to get, and you check out that record from ECM.
Well, yeah, I'll get them sent to me anyway.
Yeah, tell Tina to send you one. This is WAIF. It's quarter after 11, so we can't keep Jack too much longer, but we can still take another phone call. If you'd like to call in and talk to jazz legend Jack DeJohnette, the phone number is 961-8900. Hello, Art. You're on the air with Jack DeJohnette.
Hello, Jack.
How you doing?
This is Art Gore. You probably don't know me by name, but I'm sure you would know me if you've seen me. We go back. I'm going to take you back to the Jazz Workshop in Boston. It's where I first saw you perform at. I want to say the year was 60-something. I ain't going to say which year since we're not talking about ages here.
Uh-huh.
You were playing with Miles at the Jazz Workshop in Boston.
Yeah, I remember.
But anyway, I just want to say what an inspiration you've been. I'm a drummer, too.
Okay.
And I just want to say what an inspiration you've been, man, over the years because... And, in my formative years, of course, I listened to Max and, and Art and Elvin, of course. And, you know, I actually, when I heard Tony, I thought, like, that was the end, that was it, which, you know, led me to Boston, you know, to spend some time there with Alan.
Yeah.
And I think I heard you play, I think one of the first things I heard you play on was Forest Flower.
Uh-huh.
So you know which record I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yes. And I you know, of course, I saw you every time you came to Boston after I heard that. And I just, you know, I guess for as questions, I don't want to just, you know, just stand here and tell you how great you are. I'm sure, you know, a lot of people already know that.
Yeah, get in line, Art.
Say what? Yeah,
I get in line.
Yeah, right. You're right, Chris.
Everybody's waiting in line to tell Jack how wonderful he is. But he is. He's one of the greatest drummers of all time.
Right. You know, I can hear myself, and I can hear you, Chris, but I don't hear Jack as well as should be. I want to let you know that so your technical people can hear that.
We're working on it, Art.
Yeah, his voice should be much louder than what it is.
Do you have any other questions or comments, Art?
Yes, I do. You know, one of the things, Jack, that I've been trying to get in, and I know you've already been to, when you're talking about the technical side, as far as getting into electronics and stuff along with, you know, the natural drum sound.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever did a job where it was just you and, you know, the machine, some pre-recorded stuff or sequence stuff?
Say that again?
Have you ever played a job,
yeah,
you know, with just you playing the drums or keyboards or whatever, just you and nobody else, no other live, you know, musician?
You mean like with a sequence or
yes,
a pre-recorded tape or something?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I've done that a lot.
Have you?
Oh, yeah.
I want to do that. You know, I don't want to get locked up or anything. You know, this is Cincinnati,
Ohio.
I'm
not being locked up. It's just, no.
It's, huh?
But you got to, you know, do something that makes sense, you know. People are not used to that. That's not strange.
What would be the advantage to playing along with a sequencer besides not having to pay anybody?
No, it just adds more color to the palette. You know,
mm-hmm.
It gives you something to play off of. You know, if you
just, yeah, because the stuff is in. Yeah, like, you know, it's. I think when you if you can sequence that stuff, and Jack is a wonderful piano player. As a matter of fact, the record you were talking about that you did, where you played piano and you had Freddie Waits playing drums. That was a song on there that you did by Stanley Cowell that I really loved. I don't know if you can remember that song, but I think Stanley wrote it. I've heard it recorded a couple times. But you, I think you were, I don't know if you were playing melodica on that particular one or not.
Did that one. That was the first record. You're talking about the first record?
Yeah.
That was DJ Complex.
What was it called?
Echo Point. Equipoise,
that's it.
Yeah, but that was done, I was playing melodica.
Right.
On that. But that's not the Jack Beach, that was Freddie Waits. I didn't do that on that. I didn't do it on that.
Well, anyway, Jack, man, it's good to hear you, and I'm glad you, you know, had a chance to come in this area and spread some of your knowledge, man, and some of your wisdom about just the music business, you know, and especially drumming.
Okay,
music
great.
In general.
Okay.
Well, thanks for your call, Art, and we will be looking for an Art Gore gig at a jazz club near us.
Right, without anybody but just me and my stuff sequencing.
Just you and your pre-recorded tape. You ain't got to pay a bass player or a piano player or nothing. You get all the bread, man.
All right, take care. All right, thank you.
Have a good one.
All right.
That was apparently Art Gore, a local jazz musician here in Cincinnati, and you'll see his gigs listed in the weekly papers here. He'll be playing around some jazz club near you. So next time you see the Art Gore Quintet, or maybe the Art Gore solo with tape, go buy a ticket. We're talking to Jack DeJohnette on WAIF. It's 20 minutes after 11, and we're going a little longer than we agreed, so we'll try to wrap it up here in a minute. This is your last chance if you'd like to call in and say hello to Jack DeJohnette. Before we pull out of here, Jack, is there anything that you want to talk about or discuss that I may not have touched on? Is there anything you want our listeners to know about music or about your career that we have not discussed?
No, except some projects. What am I doing here? Yeah.
See, I think it's important to talk about the new stuff because we can spend forever talking about Miles and Charles Lloyd and playing, you know, back in the day. But it's the new stuff that I think is invigorating and is moving music and life forward. And that's why music in the key of Ohm is important and some of your other new projects. So if there's any other new projects you haven't clued us in on, then feel free to do
well,
so.
Well, you know, again, some people miss some of what, you know, what I'm up to. The website is up to date about what I'm going to be doing in the next couple of years. And you can get my itinerary, tour and itinerary is there. And things that I'm working on. I've actually worked on what I call the resonating bells with the Sabian cymbal company, which I, you know, made a line of cymbals for the drum set. Right now, the latest incarnation of cymbals is the Jack Pichonet Encore series, which is a whole set of hi-hats, crashes, and ride cymbals and a China type. But the new product that I've come out with, again, you've probably seen them on our website, is the resonating bells. And these are a musical instrument that I had a vision and a sound in my head for that can be used to enhance the melodic and harmonic palette of a drummer or a percussionist. There are 13 of them. They're tuned from middle C to C above middle C. So 13 of them. But you can also buy them in one or three or five, like a pentatonic scale. And they have special holders that they go on that can fit on top of your existing cymbal stands. And we have three of these holders that two that hold five of these bells, and then another holder that holds three.
Just to give the listener an idea what they look like, they kind of look like a menorah, don't they?
Just
for visual reference, you got the stick going up and you got these cymbals sitting on sticks that are next to each other.
Yeah, these stands, these holders can be tilted. The you can hear one of the bells, C sharp bell, which is on the Music in the Key of Ohm on the CD. And I'll explain why the Key of Ohm is C sharp. C sharp is the key that the East Indian musicians tune up to when they tune up with the tambour and they tune it up the audience. It's also a frequency of the earth. And so some of the monks chant, do the Om sound into the key of C sharp. So that's why I call it Music in the Key of Om. So it has a frequency to it, the earth frequency, a grounding frequency. So these bells, according to how you hit them, if you hit them with a soft mallet, like a marimba mallet, you get a warm, rich tone. One of the other things about this these bells that's really wonderful is that they sustain audibly for at least 30 to 40 seconds, which is really long. And when you hit them with a stick or something, you know, that's harder, you get higher overtones. When you hit them with a softer mallet, you get like a warm sort of really warm bell gong-like sound. So they're very fascinating, and you can use them, percussionists can use them, like in the symphony orchestras, or Latin percussionists, or, you know, a drummer can use them, you know, the whole set in a musical setting, or a person could just use them just to have it as an interesting sound.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing Music in the Key of Ohm. We're going to take one more call, and then we'll give the night back to Jack. Hello, Julia. You're on the air with Jack DeJohnette and WAIF.
Hi, Jack.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Good. I've been real interested listening to what you're talking about. I don't know a whole lot about jazz history, but I'm interested in the different instruments.
Can you speak up just a little more?
What's that?
Speak up a little bit, Julia.
Okay. Yeah. I've been interested in the different kinds of instruments and things you've been talking about. I've been taking notes. But I had a question about the audiences for live jazz.
Uh-huh.
I've heard that in the earlier days, the audiences were more into kind of like jazz theory, almost as a philosophy or something. And I wonder if you've noticed if the audiences have changed much over the years that you've been playing.
Audiences are into jazz theory?
I heard that in the earlier days, yeah, they were into it as a kind of a theoretical, philosophical kind of thing.
This is a pretty obtuse question, Julia, but we're going to go with it for the time being.
I don't know. It might have been some of that because maybe the jazz writers are more intellectual. But I think most of the audience is really kind of go for what gets to them. For me anyway, it gets to the bypasses the left brain and goes right to the heart of the matter, you know,
mm-hmm.
to the heart, to the emotional, part of the person, you know. I mean, sometimes the best thing is to have both, that it goes to the cerebral and the heart, you know, at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I found a lot of audiences, though, I think the intellectual kind of thing, in terms of theory, I don't think most of the audiences, you know, really come to that. Theory is more, I guess, not necessarily the right word, but maybe the theory is from something like the music students or might be interested in that. But the audiences, I think they really, either they like what you're doing or they don't. And I think it's what speaks to, mostly when you can speak to the heart and the head, I think that, I find that the audience respond a lot to that, in my experiences anyway.
All right.
Does that answer your question, Julia?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to check out your stuff and your website.
Oh, great.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks for calling in, Julia.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
I'm not exactly sure where she was coming from on that whole philosophical thing, but jazz audiences certainly have changed over the years, from the popularity of the swing era to the avant-gardism of the 60s and 70s to wherever jazz is now. And some insight from you might be interesting to talk about. But one thing about jazz that I don't disagree with, but that sometimes I have a problem with, is when you call it America's classical music. Of course it's America's classical music, and I have no problem with that. Sometimes I feel like that puts off a certain potential part of the audience.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because you can dance to bebop. Don't tell me you can't. I've seen people do it.
Yeah, but that's a result of, some of the people wanted to have the kind of support that, like, classical music was getting, you know. And when you get into classical, you know, sometimes it creates a sort of stiffness when you say classical. You know, I think the term classical can be misleading. I think jazz is a world of music. I think it's more that than classical music.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? The word classic, or classic jazz, and classic rock, classic this, I think it gets misused and thrown around too loosely. I think jazz music is what classical music used to be, in the sense of, from Europe, for the Romantic period, the Baroque period, there was always improvisation. And a lot of music in the world was improvised. I mean, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, they all improvised. I mean, in the styles that they wrote in, and that for that time, and the times that they were in. And then at a certain point, they stopped leaving space for people to improvise. And then the music, Western European music, then became all written, and no room for improvisation, only interpretation. But what jazz music did is that a lot of the technique, a lot of the European classical techniques and theories and harmonies were utilized into the jazz sensibility, and also the improvisation of the music. You know, it's really the difference between the two is that jazz employs some of the classical techniques and theories and that, but with some folk and some indigenous infusions into it, that I think some of the classical music needs. There are quite a few classical players that would love to improvise. They have the tools, but it's a mindset, you know, it's like that you have to slip into, move into. But I think jazz is a world music, because it's always been a potpourri of music. It's always borrowed from, places around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Still does. And that just makes it so rich and diverse. Yeah.
In terms of the staying on the same topic here, do you feel that it has helped or hindered jazz that it has moved into universities and academia? You know, jazz used to be music you heard in the streets and in the jazz clubs, and people played it. And at some point, I don't know when, maybe in the 50s or 60s, they started teaching jazz in theoretical terms in universities. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's been great for teachers, musicians who want to, you know, who really felt they wanted to dedicate themselves and give something back to the jazz community. But then another, sometimes it's put people into these positions. I guess it's kind of sort of produced almost like assembly line musicians in a way, and sort of created like a codified it to a certain degree. You know what I mean?
Yeah, a lot of universities are turning out kids, and they all sound like Michael Brecker. Every single one of them.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the downside of it. The other side of it is, you know, you have a level, at least a level of musicians, the quality musicians who can read and know theory and so forth. The next thing now that has happened, they have to break out of that and find their own voices.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that sometimes, unless you have exceptional places where the teacher says, okay, that's nice, you sound like Michael Brecker, but now what about you?
Yeah.
Nice to go through your influences, but don't stay there. You know, you need to then leave that. Say, well, I can take this and take this or that, and come up with my own voice. And so it creates a problem when the kids have to find their own voice. And I think that's some of the problems with the school musicians, as opposed to musicians who, you know, come up sort of self-taught and picked it up just doing it. So it's hard, you know, in some ways it's harder for the younger musicians, because there's so many of the musicians, the universities turn out so many musicians, there's not enough places for them to play.
And did you ever study jazz music in a classroom or academic setting, or did you just learn by playing with cats?
No, I mean, I did some self-study, and I had private teachers, but I've learned mine on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And asking people questions, yeah. Practicing and working on myself, or, you know, woodshed myself, and, you know, just keep my ears open and listening to a lot of things.
The last comment I'll make on this topic, and then we'll move on, and you can respond to this if you want or not. A few months ago on this show, I interviewed a guy named Steven Weber. And Steven Weber is a teacher, and I forget if he's at Berklee or New England Conservatory, but he teaches at one of those schools up there in Boston. And he started a class on turntablism. It's the first academic study, or the first academic class offering at a major university in how to play the turntable as a musical instrument. And a lot of the guys who came up through Brooklyn in the 70s and early 80s, Grandmaster Flash, all these cats are thinking, well, hey, now that it's moving into academia, it's all going to get sterile. Do you have any thoughts on that or not?
No, I mean, if the guy wants to do that, fine. I mean, but
does that
most of the guys who learn that stuff learn it from each other or watch it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's even necessary.
Yeah, so it seems to me that maybe when an art form moves into the classroom, it's over. Is that a fair assessment or is it not? It might just be, you know, a reactionary feeling.
I think it might be reactionary. I mean, you know, there's been some good musicians came out of Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Oh, some of the best.
You know, so, I mean, you know, there's that aspect of a sterile kind, but there's also, you know, out of that bunch, there'll be a few that rise above that.
Pat Metheny went to that school, didn't he?
Huh?
Didn't Metheny go to Berkeley?
Yeah, well, a lot of musicians went there. Yeah. You know, Gary Burden, Berkeley's a good meeting place for musicians to come together, and then they move out of there and they meet and they form groups or they go out, you know. So, I mean, you know, there's pros and cons to it. It is what it is, and I don't think it's going to change, you know. But a lot of musicians, there's still a lot of musicians out there who, you know, learn their craft from just playing with musicians, you know. They're still done that or have gone to schools but still have retained a rawness to what they do.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me and our audience, Jack DeJohnette. I appreciate your time and your candid approach to all of our questions and comments. And I'd like to take it out with a record I recently got by Wadada Leo Smith's Golden Quartet. This record came out in the year 2000 and features a track named after yourself. It's called DeJohnette.
Yeah, good, and I was going to remind everybody about the Rarum CD, which is a compilation of an artist series by ECM.
I've got that here, too. I'm probably going to follow up a track off of that following the Golden Quartet.
Yeah, it's where the artists that have been with ECM for 30 years, I have to pick their favorite tracks, and there's a whole group of musicians who've been on the label, Keith Jarrett, Pat, and Dave Hall and John Sermon, and you know, it's nice, and I like my Rarum series there.
Is there something from the Rarum CD you want me to play? I'll play anything you want. We're taking requests tonight. There's a lot of great tracks on here.
Well, yeah, I think the first one.
Third World Anthem?
Yeah. Well, okay. That could be one, or the last one. The last one, which is Picture 6, which features me on the piano with the cymbals, which are mic'd underneath so you can get the gong sound of the cymbals.
Okay, tell you what, I'll play DeJohnette from the Golden Quartet, then I'll play Picture 6 from your record Pictures and re-released on Rarum, and then at midnight tonight, the Outside Inside Jazz program will be here, and they'll probably play some more cool music as the night goes on.
Great.
How's that sound?
Okay.
Do you want to give us some comments on the Golden Quartet? I wanted to mention the lineup. It's Wadada Leo Smith on trumpet, Anthony Davis on piano, Malachi Favors on bass, and Jack DeJohnette on
drums. Late Malachi Favors, you know, he passed away.
Yeah, that was a great loss, too. Would you like to make any comments about the group or about Malachi before I play this track? Tell us a little bit about the group so people know what they're listening to.
Well, this is all Wadada's music. So Wadada's, I've known him for a lot of years, and Wadada teaches at Cal Arts, and he has a jazz studies program, and he's got I like his writing a lot, and he put together, this was his dream group, he had an idea, and he wanted to play with Anthony, Malachi, and me, and he wrote some music specifically for this. I think Golden Quartet is an album. I think we did another one called The Year of the Elephant.
Okay.
There's another CD.
Is that why he calls it the Golden Quartet? Because you guys are all solid gold to him?
Well, I don't know. But that's what he that's what he saw, you know, the Golden Quartet.
And why did he name this composition after you? It's called DeJohnette. It's the first track on the record. Just out of respect?
Yeah, I mean, because he likes what I do, you know, okay. The stuff I've done with Miles. Just a tribute, you know. It's a tribute piece.
That's pretty cool. All right, well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Ladies and gentlemen, Jack DeJohnette on WAIF. You can check out the website at www.jackdejohnette.com. And again, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with our audience tonight.
Okay, well, thank you for taking the time to spend some time with me.
Thank you, and here's the tribute from Wadada Leo Smith called DeJohnette.
All right.
Thanks.